support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a conversation with Stuart McDowell, the author of a new book, The Sinking of the SS Montebello. The Montebello was an oil tanker that was sunk by the Japanese off the coast of California, right near Cambria, California. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Tom.
Great to see you.
It's good seeing you, too. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us, how did you come to write the book about the Montebello, and how did you learn about it?
I first heard about the sinking of the Montebello, I think, someplace back in 1965 as a kid, and it was an interesting story to me. I didn't know much in the way of details, but it was a story I never forgot.
What did you think happened?
Well, as a child, all I had heard was that there was a merchant ship that had been sunk by a Japanese submarine, which I thought was so unusual because I pictured World War II, at least in the Pacific, and had no idea that there had been any impact here directly off our coast. So that was pretty interesting to me.
The mythical part of that story is, I first heard it was right off of Morro Bay.
Yeah.
And then people say, oh, it was off of Cayucas. And
yeah. As time goes along, now, of course, we know where the ship actually is located, mm-hmm. and it's off Cambria.
It was a fully loaded oil tanker on its way to the refineries.
Yes, exactly right. It was sunk on December 22nd. Remember, this is just a little over 2 weeks after mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor. It was loaded at Avila Beach down at Port San Luis, cleared the breakwater as it took off at about 1:30 in the morning. It was a few miles past Morro Rock where the captain of the ship heard explosions behind him, and that was an attack on another merchant ship.
Was that the Doheny?
Yes, that's right. That was the Larry Doheny. It was a Richfield oil tanker. And the Japanese submarine that happened to attack it was called the I-21.
So you had two Japanese submarines off the central coast.
Well, the I-21 made the attacks on the Larry Doheny and the Montebello.
Okay.
But you're correct in that there were multiple submarines mm-hmm. stationed all the way from San Diego up to Seattle.
Because they also, around the same time, torpedoed the oil processing at Santa Barbara, right?
Yes. In February of 1942, one of the submarines rose up out of the water and lobbed about 30 projectiles into the oil refinery and the oil derricks at Elwood, which is just a tiny bit north of Santa Barbara, about where UC Santa Barbara would be located right now.
Uh-huh.
So they were active all up and down the coast for about the span of a year.
That being said, it's so understandable, looking at the lens of time and place, of the locals on the California coast. They believed, many of them, that we were due for an imminent landing, an invasion by the Japanese of the California coast.
Yes, that was one of the interesting things about this, is that the coastal communities were very concerned about the potential of a land-based invasion. The Japanese really never had that plan. They didn't have the structures to be able to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that they had hoped for would be in these types of attacks that it would create public panic, which
right.
they managed to achieve. There was considerable concern all the way up and down the coast. And, of course, there were beach patrols established right after the start of Pearl Harbor in Washington, Oregon, and California.
Mm-hmm. And we had gun emplacements along the central coast, right?
We did, yeah, in many different places, especially around harbors. So Fort MacArthur near San Pedro.
Avila on the hilltop, right? Wasn't there a gun emplacement there?
I'm not familiar with that, if there were gun emplacements mm-hmm. above Avila, but I know that there had been gun emplacements right near here.
Mm-hmm. In North Morro Bay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'd heard about that. And of course, one of the other stories that sometimes comes up from this is that after the attack on the Montebello, that there was an effort by the government to suppress the attack so that people wouldn't be too frightened or scared, in an effort to kind of prevent public panic.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the myths that I'd heard many times was that the FBI had swooped down and bought all the newspapers in San Francisco and in the Central Coast, you know, eliminating the newspaper coverage of this attack. I think it's a myth, partly because in the previous days before the Montebello, there had been at least four different attacks on merchant ships by Japanese submarines.
Mm-hmm.
We'd already talked about the beach patrols have been established. And then the Rose Bowl game for January 1st, 1942, between Oregon State and Duke, that had already been moved back to Durham, North Carolina,
because
the government was concerned about a large public gathering that would be vulnerable to a Japanese air attack. So if the FBI were ever trying to prevent public panic, they were far too late by that time.
All that happened right after Pearl Harbor propelled the paranoia of people on the California coast relative to the Japanese, the Nisei and Issei, and why Roosevelt signed executive order relocating all Japanese away from the California Central Coast. Because of that fear and paranoia.
Yes, that's right. That was a huge contributor to the act that instigated the internment of the Japanese Americans.
Okay, so now Montebello is close to Cambria, about 6 miles off the coast, and a torpedo hits it. Captain knows that he's in trouble.
Yes, it's a trip that the Montebello had made hundreds of times, but along the way, they had seen that the Larry Doheny had been attacked just outside of Morro Bay, and the options for the captain were pretty limited. The captain of the Montebello was a man named Olof Ekström. He was a Swedish-born captain, emigrated to the United States right after World War I. But he knew that with the explosions behind him, he couldn't return back to Port San Luis. His only option was to go north and hopefully be able to put as many miles between him and an attacking submarine as he could. The problem for him was that the I-21 was a I-class submarine that was capable of great speed. So it could hit 24 knots on the surface easily make up any gap of miles with the Montebello. And sure enough, after unsuccessfully attacking the Larry Doheny, he caught up with the Montebello up near Cambria. And they came up following right in the wake of the ship. Captain Ekström had lookouts that had spotted what they thought was a conning tower. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, it was the conning tower of the I-21. And he had lookouts that kept relaying to him, was the submarine closing? And in fact, it was. It was a mile. It was 3/4 mile. And where its relative position was to the ship. So he was always getting information on that and knew that he was in big trouble.
When the torpedo struck the Montebello, did Ekström know pretty much right away that he was in deep trouble?
I think he knew he was in deep trouble, but he wasn't sure that the ship was going to sink. Mm-hmm. The torpedo, the ones used by the Japanese Navy, this particular one was something called a Type 95 torpedo. It was a devastating weapon, 23 feet in length, and packed nearly a half-ton warhead.
Wow.
So it was very powerful. Technologically advanced, fast. It went through the water at about 50 miles an hour.
Whoa.
And sensitive. It was reliable on exploding.
The fuse worked every time.
The fuse worked every time.
Yeah.
Exactly. So they came up about, I'd say, a mile at first and then closed those gaps. The captain of the submarine was a man named Kanji Matsumura. When he reached his favorable attack point about 900 yards away, it's a textbook distance to be able to sink a tanker. With one release of the torpedo, about 40 seconds later, it's traveled those 900 yards and hit the Montebello on the starboard side with such tremendous force that it caused this 440-foot tanker to lurch leftward and then just begin to shudder and stop.
Why did it not explode?
The Montebello itself didn't explode. Even though it's carrying a pretty combustible cargo, it didn't explode because the torpedo had struck a dry storage hold. It was about 40 feet back from the bow of the ship, and it wasn't where the oil holds were.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a miraculous piece of luck that the torpedo happened to strike in the one hold that there wasn't explosive cargo. Mm-hmm. The men aboard knew that fire was a tremendous hazard to them, so they were always worried that if any fire broke out from that torpedo explosion, should that catch fire with the cargo of the Montebello, that you could have a catastrophic explosion, and that would take everybody down.
So at what point did Ekström send out a mayday?
He sent out a message as soon as they spotted the submarine saying, "Submarine attempting to attack." And then when the torpedo struck, he tried to get another message out, but everything was down. The radio operation equipment was down. He said send out one through the emergency radio. That was down as well. There was electrical failure. The rudder was out. Almost nothing on the ship worked after that torpedo strike.
So at some point, there's a hero tugboat that still is in Morro Bay, the Alma.
Yes, that's right.
They were a first responder. How did the Alma know what was going on?
The Alma and another boat called the Estero, two tugboats, they were over in Estero Bay waiting for a tanker to come in. And with the attack on the Montebello, they were quickly dispatched to go up to Cambria and start searching for lifeboats. So to me, they're one of the multiple compelling stories of this. One of the captains, Merrill Molinari, and another captain named Pete Stocking, they took those boats up. They know they're going in harm's way. Mm-hmm. They know there's the potential that they could be the victim of the deck gun.
And they're unarmed. They have no...
And they're completely unarmed. Exactly. Yeah. They have nothing.
Yeah.
But they went up and found three of those lifeboats. Mm-hmm. So they were able to save 30 of those crew members from the Montebello. So that's another part of the compelling story of the rescue.
And then the other component are the Cambrians.
The Cambrians were heroic that day. They rose up in a great way. And that's, to me, one of my favorite stories of the entire event, is that the last lifeboat that contained Captain Ekstrom and the remaining five members of his crew, they were in lifeboat number one, and that lifeboat had sustained some damage. Not only was a torpedo fired at the ship, but there were about seven or eight salvos from the deck gun. After the torpedo had been fired, the submarine rose to the surface and then used the deck gun, firing five-inch projectiles that just packed a wallop to try to speed the sinking of the tanker. One of them snapped off the foremast. One of them hit and exploded right by the bow of lifeboat number one. And so there had been shrapnel damage to that lifeboat. There were holes in the bow. So when they got that boat into the water to get into it, they found it's got oil in it and it's got water in it, and we have no other choice. We have no other place to go, so it's live and die with lifeboat number one. So those men got into that boat, and Ekstrom's decision as he got into it was to just make a beeline as fast as he could for the shore. It was a distance away. He wasn't sure how far that was, but he was just going to try to see if they could get to the shore. So he had four men rowing with the oars, one man continuously bailing, and he was at the end using an oar to steer the lifeboat. Very arduous task.
And again, my recollection is that the Montebello sunk about 6 miles off the coast.
Yes, it did. You're almost exactly right. It was 6.2 miles. But there was question about this after the sinking. One of the first things that Union Oil did was to pursue a lawsuit against the federal government to retain or to get back
compensation.
Yeah, exactly, for the cargo and the ship.
But they had to be within the 3 mile international limit, right?
Yes. They had to be within a 3 mile territorial limit. So their claims, it was within 3 miles. Nobody knew for sure. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, it was a task that was going to have to be determined by a jury. So eventually, you had the case come to court in San Francisco in 1946, where Union Oil was suing the federal government, and something kind of a, ultimately, Union Oil loses that case after a week long court battle. And it's determined that that boat was sunk 6 miles offshore.
Interesting. 80 years later, the Montebello is still on the ocean floor, packed with oil.
It's still on the ocean floor, but not packed with oil. That's one of the things that we learned as the years went by. Basically, for about 50 years, the ship sits undisturbed at the bottom of the ocean. And in the early 1990s, the Monterey Bay Marine Sanctuary is established. And then the Montebello becomes a point of interest again, not because of its historical significance, but because of its potential for an ecological disaster.
I remember that. There was fear that the containers would be corroding away and then the oil would come out.
3.1 million gallons is
wow.
A lot of oil.
Where'd it go?
So there was initially a expedition that NOAA had, National Oceanographic Atmospheric Association, had put together. 1995, Jack Hunter, who was the local guy down, lives in Los Osos. He was the project director. They went down, found the Montebello, located it, and circumnavigated it with a deep sea submersible four times. During that process, they were trying to look at the integrity of the hull and see what kind of shape it was in. It was sitting upright on the bottom of the floor, he said, as if tied to a dock. So it appeared to be in decent shape, and there was no clear evidence of any oil leaking. It didn't tell the full story. So back in 2003 now, another expedition is sent down. Jack Hunter's part of this one as well. And they attempt to find, is there any bacterial or evidence of oil pollution? There's a particular bacteria that grows when it's in the ocean, that's when it's subjected to pollution. There was no evidence of that whatsoever. There was no visible leakage of oil at all. So ultimately, they determined, we don't think it's a threat, but we don't know what's in the cargo holds themselves. So now, yet again, a third expedition in 2011, where they'd send down some kind of nuclear-aged equipment, so where they're able to measure the thickness of the hull, the steel plates there, and then send an electronic signal through each section of the hull to see what's on the other side of it. They're able to determine what's on the other side because there's a kind of a signature response or relay With water, you get one signal, and with oil, you get another signal. And they consistently were getting information that this is water back behind there. So they had to develop some scenarios, some hypothetical scenarios on what happened to the oil. They put a number of them through computer scenarios and ran those out. And the one that made the most sense to them, is that since they couldn't find evidence of oil being on the ship right now, was a long-term release after the ship had been sunk itself. So the likelihood of any quantifiable amount of oil on the ship remaining now, they said, was negligible. They think that it was a sustained release, yes. Most of it dissipating out at shore, other parts of it washing up on shore, but so widely spread over such a long area that nobody paid much attention to it.
Years ago, I heard the story that the oil was in there, but it had coagulated to a point where it was no longer viscous.
Yes, I'd heard that as well. And I think those were the types of theories that people were coming up with before they had any other information, like the 2011 expedition, where you had the neutron backscatters sending information through the hull and then getting the feedback.
Any physical remnants, the lifeboats, life jackets, anything remain on the Central Coast?
I've heard there's a life jacket.
I saw one in Cayucas years ago. It was in the front window of an antique shop.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
There was a person who showed me like a silver butter dish that had a cover on it that said the Montebello that they had.
But no lifeboats.
No lifeboats.
All gone.
The lifeboat that was that Captain Ekstrom was in, that crashed into the surf and to the rocks south of Cambria. It was at a place called Sibley Ranch.
That was another nuance of that disastrous day, that the guys could have made it almost to shore and then be smashed by waves on the rocks.
You know? Yes.
That was a real threat.
Yeah. By the time they reached those rocks, keep in mind that this is in December 1941. The water at that time of year is in the upper 40s. It hurts to touch it. It's so cold. They've been exposed to this for hours. They're exhausted having come in. They're wet from the rain. They're frozen and exhausted. And now they're faced with rocks. There's no place for them to land the lifeboat.
And that's where the Cambrians became the heroes.
Where the Cambrians became the heroes, exactly. And the funny thing was, is that there were six guys in the boat. Five of them made a jump for it because there were large breakers that day. And as they approached the rocks, five of these guys jumped over the edge, thinking they had a better chance of surviving if they were able to somehow crawl out onto the rocks, which was going to be a difficult task. One guy, a fireman named Edgar Smith, stayed in the boat. And a large swell came, lifted the boat up. The nose of it got over these rocks, and Edgar Smith stepped out onto the without any incident at all. So the one guy that stayed in the boat actually was able to just step off safely. The others, they had to work very hard to be able to throw lifelines to them. It was courageous on the Cambrians' part. They were risking themselves being down on very slippery rocks, and several guys, you know, were overcome by those waves, knocked out into the water, and they had to be pulled out as well. So Cambria stood tall that day.
And then I remember there was some issue when they were sent to a hospital. They went to a sanitarium, and then there was some blowback and issues where they relocated them to, I think, Camp San Luis, right?
Yes, they were.
What was that about?
I'm not positive, because I read that as well, that they were taken to a sanitarium.
The sanitarium in San Luis, there was one on Santa Barbara Street, right near the railroad depot.
Oh, is that where that would have been?
Yeah.
Of course, three of the lifeboats were landed at Cayucas, so they're separated from the fellows that are up in Cambria. And I know that really it's at Camp San Luis Obispo that they're all reunited again.
Anything that we haven't talked about that you're fascinated with?
There's a reconfirmation for me, in a way, of the way that people can rise to excellence in the face of an emergency or a catastrophe, a crisis. The crew of the Montebello did that as they sailed up to Vancouver, knowing there's the potential of the submarines, the tugboat captains that we spoke about, and then the people up in Cambria. People were in a crisis and best came out. So it's just an encouraging story on every level to me, and each of the individuals that just rose to the occasion. It's a great story of human resilience and facing difficulties with great courage.
And Captain Ekstrom wasn't scared away. He went back and
he did
got another command, right?
He did. He went back and was a captain with the Union Oil Fleet mm-hmm. for the remainder of his career. He retired in, I think, in the late 1950s, so he was back on the ocean for many years thereafter.
That's really cool. One of the nuances that you and I are both aware of are locals. Some of the people that I met were kids at this time. And one guy's memory is one of the errant torpedoes hit Morro Rock and blew it up. And the torpedo blew with such force that it woke everybody up in Morro Bay, freaked them out. He said a lot of people got in their cars and went to Tascadero to go hide.
The torpedo that exploded was the one that was fired at the Larry Doheny. Nobody's entirely sure what it hit that caused the explosion. After the war, there was a Japanese Navy commander who said that these particular torpedoes were technologically advanced, but their shortcoming was that they would explode when they hit turbulent water, such as the wake of the ship. So one of the things that I'd always speculated was that that particular torpedo hit the wake of the Larry Doheny and exploded. The thing that is absolutely true is how devastating and enormous that the concussion of that explosion was. There was a woman up in Cayucas named Arlene Gennardini. Her husband was Roy Gennardini, the constable, and ran a local auto repair garage. They had been woken by the first few explosions, but when the torpedo went off, she said that the concussion nearly knocked her out of bed.
Wow.
I talked to another local up in the Cayucas area, and he said that he had a friend that lived up near Point Estero and had the same experience. The concussion was so great that he thought the house was going to cave in. And it was reported in the newspapers that windows in San Luis Obispo rattled, and that's 13 miles away. So this is a tremendously powerful explosion, mm-hmm. 900 pounds of TNT that went up. And so they had every right to be scared.
One more favorite recollection.
On the rescue down at Sibley Ranch, by the time that boat had reached the shoreline, and we had already talked about how exhausted these guys were, Ekstrom was in the water. Captain Ekstrom's in the water. And he has absolutely nothing left. He's frozen to the bone. He's exhausted from steering that lifeboat all these miles to shore. And he's in the water, and he doesn't even have the ability to reach for a lifeline that has been thrown to him. And a man from Morro Bay, David Chase was his name, 24 years old, decides to jump into the water, into the just freezing cold water, swim out to Ekstrom, and somehow secure a lifeline to him so he can be pulled in.
Oh, that's a hero.
That is. That's just a remarkable individual mm-hmm. story. But someone who just instantaneously said, this has to be done. Mm-hmm. And so those types of things are great pieces to remember. I'm glad that I knew about his effort so that it could be recalled here 80 years later.
That's really cool. Stuart McDowell, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
We've been visiting with Stuart McDowell, the author of The Sinking of the SS Montebello, when World War II came to the central coast of California. The book is available at the Morro Bay Maritime Museum and bookstores around the world. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
Support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter, down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolfe, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.